You're listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
I have a corridor lined up with an expert on Te Tiriti. He's just written a new book that I'm holding in my hand. I'm flicking the paper right in the mic, so you know it's real. We've got Ross Kalman on the line, who's coming to us live from Christchurch. We're going to be talking about the new book he's just done called The Treaty of Waitangi, Te Tiriti or Waitangi. Morena, Ross. How you doing?
Oh, kia ora, Zach, and kia ora to the listeners. Yeah, I'm doing well, thanks.
Nice. Christchurch, I hear, is pretty summery at the moment.
Oh, finally, it's sort of come to the party a wee bit, just as everyone's going back to work, of course.
Mm-hmm. Is it kind of a brutal summer, you know, like real intense sun, quite dry, or is it more forgiving?
We've had a really cold summer so far, and now we're in the low 20s and we're kind of celebrating, so...
Nice. I'm not usually acclimatized to the heat. Like yesterday it was sweltering, and I'm going to Melbourne in a couple of weeks, so I'm going to have to pack some ice water or something, you know.
Yeah.
It's going to be a brutal time. But we're here to talk about your new book, which is kind of has a very similar title to a book that you wrote in 2003 titled The Treaty of Waitangi. How does that book from 22 years ago, far out, differ from this one which came out yesterday? And who would you say is your target audience with this new book?
Yeah, well, with both books, I suppose I'm just trying to provide an accessible introduction to the treaty, to its history, which is not just the events of leading up to 1840, but also what's happened since 1840. And so with this new book, I've been able to cover a lot more recent material that takes us right up to date, including the introduction of the Treaty Principles Bill into Parliament. Of course, we don't quite know the outcome of that one just yet. Mm-hmm. But if anyone is looking just for like an introduction, which this book is well illustrated as well, then this is the one for you.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that the former book came out in 2003, because that was right before or during the foreshore and seabed protests?
That was a little bit before all of that action.
It seems like you're always getting in on the wave, never quite landing.
Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, if you look at the last section of the book, you'll note that there's pretty regular major, I don't know if conflict is the right word, but certainly disagreements between Māori and the Crown. Mm. And perhaps the general public too, about certain issues. And so, yeah, not only was there the foreshore and seabed controversy, but there was also things like the Tūhoe raids in the 2000s.
Yeah, Ihu Mātou as well.
Ihu Mātou, which is a little bit more recent again. Mm-hmm. So this stuff, you know, look, some people would love it just to go away, but it's not going away. It's something that Māori especially are constantly living with, their sort of arrangements for governance of this country, but also not just that, also the unequal allocation of resource in terms of lands and other resources, which means that basically Māori are living in an impoverished state, on, you know, just in general compared with other New Zealanders. So. Mm-hmm. That, you know, that's something that certainly hasn't gone away.
I had a lecturer for a paper about the Waitangi Tribunal. He's an excellent, very intelligent man called Pairo Warbrick. And he had a really good saying about, you know, ACT wanting to legally, I guess, destroy the treaty and make it legally non-binding. But he said the thing about the treaty is more than just a piece of paper. It's a spiritual relationship and between Māori and the Crown, and the Crown will always have a duty to fulfill and make good on its promises. It's just a matter of whether it chooses to do so or not, which I think is fundamentally what it comes down to.
Oh, I totally agree with that. And if you look at the history of the country, for most of the time, the government has chosen to ignore it. There's only been the odd glimpse. And in the first few years after it was signed, the government was certainly very more scrupulous about honouring it. But it wasn't long after it was signed that successive governors such as George Grey came into power and decided that the treaty was a very inconvenient piece of paper, and that actually, you know, the Crown at that time needed to marshal its troops and, you know, go to war with Māori. So And that's kind of like, I see the kind of repercussions or the kind of the modern day, this sort of like a modern day, it's like the legacy of those times and that way of thinking. I see that very much with the likes of Axe approach. It's kind of like they're just like the inheritors of the New Zealand company and and George Gray, and basically it's just about making money and, you know, things like treaties and Māori, just a little bit of an inconvenience and how can we kind of legislate the problem away type of thing.
It's a historical dialogue, or dialectic, what's-his-face would say. Anyway, I can't remember that philosopher. But this book starts off with sharing some historical perspectives from statesmen and lawyers, talking about Te Tiriti as a device for allowing Britain to set up shop in Aotearoa. And some of the quotes were less favourable about the intention of Te Tiriti, where others, like Governor-General Lord Bledisloe, said that the treaty was a sacred compact. Well, just 60-odd years before that, the Chief Justice, James Prendergast, called it a mere nullity in the 1870s. Was the perception among lawyers, statesmen and politicians on the treaty changing into a more positive mindset as time rolled closer to the treaty centenary in 1940?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. It's interesting, if you look at what happened 50 years after the treaty was signed, so in 1890, there were some celebrations, but they chose to honour Hobson's date that he made an announcement, actually not even in New Zealand, he was actually still in Sydney at the time, when he declared British sovereignty over New Zealand before even arriving. So that was the date they chose in 1890 rather than the 6th of February, but fast forward to 1940, and I think the nation had matured a bit and realised that, well, at that time it was a very much a bicultural sort of proposition between Māori and Pākehā, and it wasn't sort of the multiplicity of immigration we've had since that time. And I think that's right. That Lord Bledisloe was the one who purchased the treaty house and the treaty grounds at Waitangi, and you know that had fallen into a dilapidated state by that point, and so it was kind of like a bit of nation building at that time, and it probably 1940 when it came around happened to be in the middle of a world war, so the 1940 commemorations were probably a little bit muted.
I quite like oh my god, what's his name? Apirana Ngata. His speech at the 1940 centenary, you can go and listen to it on, I think it's Ngā Taonga, Silent Vision, and it's truly something. It's, for the times, very, I think, forward-thinking. And pretty honest as well.
Yeah, I mean, Ngata was a great statesman, and very much had that backdrop of the World War and that conscious effort to send Māori abroad to remind the rest of New Zealand that they were citizens of this country and were prepared to pay the ultimate sacrifice.
I love how in this book, when you're starting off talking about the actual treaty signing and the events that happened on the treaty grounds, I love how you've included direct quotes from rangatira who were both for and against signing Te Tiriti. And there's a clear understanding from the no's that they have a lot to lose, with many questioning if the governor of New Zealand would be literally above them in terms of power. And it seems pretty clear to me from the onset, that there was a strong desire to retain mana motuhake, or sovereignty. The thing that confuses me is, why don't those who disagree that Māori didn't cede sovereignty simply bite the bullet and acknowledge this when they're talking about the treaty? It's so confusing.
Yeah, I mean, it is. One of the things that does confuse the debate is that we're quite a monolingual country, and so we often just look at the English text. But if you look at the Māori text, it's a lot more clear about what the treaty meant. And of course, the Māori text is the one that just about everyone signs. So it's a bit of a distraction to actually look at the English too much. So I suppose some people find it confusing that, Māori kept Tino Rangatiratanga sovereignty, and on the British side, they established a governor. And so those two things happened in the same document. And I suppose that's the thing that people find hard to reconcile, because we're thinking very much a modern day lens, you know, well, how can you have a government and, you know, have Māori being a sovereign, but also have a government over here? But, you know, you've got to think back to then, and there was only 2,000 non-Māori in the country. Māori really had all the cards at that time and were running the country and had been running the country along with, you know, Pākehā living amongst them for close to 50 years, if you, you know, consider the sealers, whalers, the missionaries and so on. Mm. And so, yeah, there was a bit of a dual system, and I think, you know, at the beginning, the British were kind of thinking, well, you know, in terms of looking after or keeping in line the British subjects who are here, and the ones who would arrive as settlers, you know, they probably did consider that there could be like a dual system, in terms of Māori having sovereignty and looking after, you know, the rangatira. It was a whole strata. It was all set up already in society. I mean, why would the British nullify that? It wouldn't have made any sense, and it still doesn't really make, you know, all that sense, because the British basically, like I say, Māori had a lot of power at the time, and they had all the lands, all the resources, and so, yeah, it was very much, I suppose, an agreement of its time, but when you look at it now, it doesn't seem like a dated document. It seems quite far-reaching and also incredibly, you know, future kind of proof and considering the future as well. So, I think that's where the debate really rightly belongs today, is looking at how do we enact that tiro rangatira tanga for Māori within this modern nation that we have of Aotearoa New Zealand, which, you know, in which there's room for everyone who's made a home here.
Totally. And I totally agree. It's very, very far future thinking, which is ironic considering the British Empire about 40 years later would go to Africa and do some really, really horrifying stuff there. And, you know, it's just it's weird that they can do this on one hand and just completely destroy a continent with the other, you know. It's bizarre, frankly.
Things swung the other way not long after the treaty was arranged. That kind of thinking about the British being sort of like a superior race and anyone of colour was below them in the scale, the grand sort of scheme of things.
Yeah, scientific racism, yeah.
Yeah, and that kind of enabled, yeah, as you say, all the terrible stuff that happened in Africa. I mean, recently I was actually just reading about the South African War, which of course is another thing again, but again, that was quite a horrific conflict that New Zealand was part of and sort of enabled, in which you know, concentration camps were kind of invented as a thing, and women and children were kept in these terrible camps, and yeah. So yeah, I mean, there's yeah.
I believe the Boer War is actually where the first ever instance of the ANZAC Corps happened. It was even before World War One that the ANZAC Corps was formed.
That would make sense, yeah.
Yeah. Colonisation, though it heavily involves the state, also involves private interests, and there were huge lobbying efforts made for the Brits to secure Aotearoa from private banks and finance, as well as from the New Zealand Company, which needed to buy up as much land as cheaply as possible to turn a profit. Now, if we only focus on the public redressal and not the private one, are we missing half the picture when it comes to reparations?
It's an issue that everyone's been a bit too scared to touch.
I know, it's infuriating though, because this is a huge portion of what happened. It's a huge portion of our history.
I mean, it's crazy when you think back to the New Zealand Company that basically sold all the land. They didn't actually have to sell, they'd already sold it in London. And that created the issue that when they got here of needing to obtain land as cheaply as possible from Māori, and why they went to desperate lengths to make that happen. And eventually, with the help of Governor George Grey, you know, they did manage to kind of steal or confiscate or whatever the land that they needed to sell. In terms of like, I mean, I think in terms of like looking at private individuals and families, I honestly think everyone does need to interrogate their own past and their own history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how did they get the things that they value now, such as property or education or good health, all those sort of what we might call basic things? How did they come to be in the position they are? And it's, yeah, it's quite, I think that, you know, we all have a kind of, everyone that's here probably has some sort of myth about how they got here and how their family established themselves here and what was bestowed to the descendants. But if we look, you know, a lot of those myths, when we start to look at them, don't actually withstand much scrutiny. And so, as I say, I think that's something that everyone has to do for themselves and just to come to peace with it. Or, you know, or perhaps there may be things that they can actually do to, in their own past and background, that practical steps to reach out to Māori perhaps, or to learn Te Reo Māori or whatever it is. I mean, it might be just getting to know history a bit better and understanding what, you know, all these debates we're having now, none of them are actually new at all. They've all kind of been around basically ever since this country's been around. So yeah,
totally. It's just infuriating when you see like some of those. I heard about a few farms up in the North Island which are kind of run by Pākehā families, and they're very proud of how long they've been on the land for, and it's like, well, how did you get that land? You know, they need to maybe come to terms with that. And I mean, I don't know if the Catholic Church can give away some of their churches and land. I don't see why some rich people couldn't do the same. But anyway,
well, the churches would be a great example, because there's also the Anglican Church, of course, which is I think the biggest private landowner in New Zealand.
Exactly. I noticed in your criticism of the treaty settlement section that you didn't mention that the Crown only makes settlements with what they call large natural groupings, as to, I guess, reduce the complexity of treaty redress. As we've seen with the Pakakoi and Tangahoe iwi, who were rejected for individual treaty redress and were lumped in with the Ngāti Ruanui iwi for historical claims negotiation. Do you think it's possible to saliently make treaty settlements when, you know, I guess they're coming at it as though Māori society is quite simple?
Yeah, I mean, I may not use that exact phrase in that section, but I do talk about it has been a very political process coming up with these entities to represent iwi and hapu. Of course, if we look historically, the hapu was really the independent grouping of Māori, and iwi was more something that would only be resorted to and perhaps in a crisis such as warfare or something like that. And today, I mean, that's just been a practical move by the government so that they didn't have to deal at a whānau, you know, whānau level with these settlements. And because, yeah, that's the reality, is that often whānau within hapu may disagree on, you know, on the path forward. It has been a contentious process, and as you mentioned, some of those groups do feel like they're getting a very raw deal indeed, and not being represented by the body that's been nominated to represent them. I don't really don't quite have a solution for that one. It's just come with that territory, I guess. And I suppose, I mean, the treaty settlements, I saw something recently was saying that the treaty settlements, the total spent on treaty settlements is less than tax advantages for landlords that have been recently being passed. So, you know, there's a lot of kind of palaver about treaty settlements, I guess, or people have been critical about them, but, you know, in the scheme of things, we're actually talking about something that's more about the honour, actually, rather than about the amount of money that's involved.
I definitely think they could do with more money, though. They could definitely do with more money. I mean, the original fiscal envelope in the 90s was $1 billion, which is just ridiculous. To think $1 billion in 1990s money could compensate for losing two whole islands is ridiculous. Well, more than two whole islands, frankly. It's so...
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the Ngāi Tahu situation. You know, that's what over two thirds of the Wai Pounamu was basically brought under Kemp's deed for £2,000. You know, that's just not right. They were meant to set aside reserves at schools and hospitals and so on. None of those reserves were set aside at anywhere near the size that they needed to be to support people. And so they just as with other confiscations, it just created impoverishment.
I want to touch on the tribunal while I have you here, because I know we've been going for quite a long time, but I'm really enjoying this chat. In an article called The Regulation of Māori Protest, the authors Juan Todi and Robert Webb say that despite the Waitangi Tribunal's enormous benefits, it is, at an institutional level, removed Māori radicalism off the streets and national television and into a formal law setting. What do you make of that notion?
Oh, I mean, that's kind of why the government were forced to set up the tribunal, because if you look back to the early 70s, it was a time of radical Māori activism. And it highlighted all the injustices that had happened in the past. And so the government of the day, you know, that was a direct response to that activism, set up the tribunal. Therefore, the activism kind of had a result, and we've had the tribunal. The tribunal's done an incredible job. I mean, if you look at the legacy of Sir Eddie Jury, it's just incredible. Just the understanding of our past, but also, going a long way towards reconciliation, I guess, between Māori and Pākehā and other peoples too who live here. I don't think that stopped anyone who's had an issue with something to go out and protest. I mean, we just mentioned a few of those things before. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, maybe it was when we were chatting, when we were off here, but, you know, for example, the Ihu Mātau and other occupations and so on. And, you know, we could talk about the recent hikoi to Parliament. There's nothing stopping protest, and protest has continued. So I think, I think it's almost... sounds like a bit of a naive statement to say that the tribunals sort of replaced radicalism because that is actually where it came from, and that was kind of the point of it, was to give a fair hearing for Māori and for iwi.
I guess the point might not be that it replaced it, but might have bureaucratized it, I guess. I wrote a big essay about neoliberalism in the tribunal, and in that I read a lot of leftist, I guess, treaty academics, and there's a lot of really, really interesting theories floating around there about how, I don't know, the process is quite neoliberal, and it's quite draining on a lot of the iwi trusts, and a lot of them find it very infuriating. You have to pay all these fancy lawyers X amount of money, and it's just not as organic and as real as it could be.
Yeah, I've been involved in treaty hearings up at just north of Ōtaki, at Ngāti Wehiwehi. And it's a really wonderful, I found a really affirming process. It really brought the hapū together. It made us research our history, and we became aware of all this kōrero that we'd never known before. It really strengthened our whanaungatanga, our bonds with one another. And so although it is technically a court setting, I think it's had enormous benefit for Māori.
Totally.
Lawyers are involved and have made money from the process. It would be kind of I don't really want to quibble about the contributions that lawyers have made, because, a lot of that legal thinking has been quite revolutionary, and it's enabled us to think about different ways of resolving some of these issues that may not have come about without the kind of contribution from legal minds. So anything like that's going to be an expensive operation to run. But if you actually looked at how much money was... how much money it did cost, I don't think we'd find it would be an alarming alarming amount. I think it's just a bit of kind of scaremongering that, oh, you know, the only people benefit, you know, that's the kind of the old cliche, the only people benefiting from it are lawyers.
Mm. And that's ACT's kind of whole tagline, is that there's this whole industry around trivia settlements, which isn't true, I don't think.
But, no, I think that if you look at the legal profession, I think there's actually relatively few lawyers who make their living in that area.
Alrighty, I really want to thank you for coming on the program and having such a long, fascinating and thorough corridor about the treaty and your new book. It's fantastic. I want to finish off on asking, you know, what would you say to people who are in support of the Treaty Principles Bill but might not have investigated and reflected on our country's history and the treaty in full?
Yeah, I mean, that's all I can ask of people, is to look into the history a bit more, because I see this bill as being just something, another tired idea that's been rolled out, that's kind of been current actually since the 1840s, so it's actually not current or new at all. So yeah, all I'd say is have another think about it, because it's either you want to live honourably with your fellow citizens, or... yeah, dishonorably. That's kind of how I put it.
Those are the two, the poles, one might say. Thank you very much for coming on the program. I hope you have a fantastic day, and all the best of luck with your new book.
Great, thank you. Thanks, Zach.
Thank you very much. All right, folks. That was Ross Kalman coming on to Corridor about his new book, The Treaty of Waitangi, which is a very, 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 very fantastic read. I highly recommend you read it. You can find it at oratia.co.nz. It's 9:30 a.m. and we are going to play a classic treaty anthem. We've got Moana and the Moa Hunters with Treaty. You're listening to The One. Keep it locked.
We're Māori, and we won't get justice till we've got a Māori flag.
That was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. You can find more of them at r1.co.nz/podcast.